This is Examining Education, a new radio series that looks at important issues related to education. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Our first four programs will be addressing fundamental issues that should provide a foundation for subsequent discussions. Today, our first program will consider whose responsibility it is to provide public education. The second program will cover how public education should be funded. The third program will discuss who should determine school curriculum, and the fourth program will address teacher accountability. Topics for future programs will be chosen on the basis of audience and producer input, so do go to our website, Examining Education, and follow us on Facebook. Here on this first program, we will consider the right to an education and ask, is there a responsibility to provide education to all? And if so, whose responsibility is it? Our two distinguished speakers for this program, James Anderson of the University of Illinois and Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute, have very different answers to our initial questions. It may surprise many of you to hear that nowhere in our federal constitution or Bill of Rights is public education or the right to public education mentioned. By 1917, though, all states had laid out such rights explicitly. Illinois' constitution, for example, declares this right particularly strongly. Section 1, Goal. Free schools. A fundamental goal of the people of the state is the educational development of all persons to the limits of their capacities. The state shall provide for an efficient system of high-quality public educational institutions and services. Education in public schools through the secondary level shall be free. Although both speakers agree that a functioning democracy depends on an educated citizenry and that all children should have access to a quality education, they disagree about what the best method is to achieve these ends. Jim Anderson believes it is the state's responsibility to make these goals possible, and Andrew Coulson thinks a more efficient path to universal literacy is through the marketplace. And now, let me welcome our distinguished speakers. Thank you both so much for agreeing to appear on our program.
Well, this is Andrew Coulson speaking, and I entered this field in 1994 after having been a computer software engineer. And the reason I switched into public policy is that I saw education falling behind every other field in our economy. In my field in particular, the pace of advance has been incredible, and yet our schools were not improving at the same rate, and because of it, kids were falling further and further behind the level of education that's required to be successful in our market economy. And so I wanted to find out, what is it that is causing education to lag behind other fields? How can we make it enjoy the same sense of progress, the same achievements that we're having in other fields? And in general, I've found in looking at the history of education around the world and at modern statistical studies, I found that systems in which parents are in the driver's seat and in which schools compete for the opportunity to serve them tend to do a much better job of fulfilling both their individual needs and our social goals for education.
And now, Jim?
Jim Anderson. My field is the history of American education, which is a field that I've studied since my graduate education, and a field in which I do research and teach in. I've looked at American education historically and the origins and evolutions of state systems of public education. I'm very much interested in the education of different groups. My special field is the history of African American education, and so I come to this with sort of looking at the origins and development of public education in a historical context, as well as with some real concerns about where we are and where we're going. I would agree that we have real problems in our educational system, and we do need to make serious improvements. But when I look at other dominant institutions in society, whether it's the economy, whether it's government, I also realize that education is not the only field that's having real problems at the moment. So there are a lot of areas of American life and culture that need to be improved, education being among them.
And now to our main question, is there a right to education? Andrew.
In a legal sense, as you noted, in the federal constitution, there is no right to education, whereas in most, if not all, of the state constitutions, there is an explicit right to providing an education. If you ask people, though, whether or not they are familiar with the laws of their particular state or whether they're familiar with the details of the United States Constitution, they will tell you they feel a personal obligation to ensure that every child in America has access to a quality education and that that education prepare them not just for success in private life, but for participation in public life. I look at a lot of polling data across several related fields, and I never see topics on which you see such high agreement as this universal feeling that Americans have personally, that they want to ensure their fellow citizens and their children are well educated. So, in effect, there is this universal desire to see that every child is well educated. And the question then to me becomes, the important question then to me becomes, how do you fulfill that? How do you provide that quality education that everyone wants to provide? And my conclusion in looking at the research is that you don't do it through providing it through the state, but rather trying to get the state to make it possible for people to provide this for themselves and for philanthropy to ensure that it's universally available.
Jim?
You know, it is true that many Americans often speak of education as though it is a right, and they often use the phrase right to education. But the Supreme Court actually ruled in the Rodriguez case that under the federal constitution, education is a privilege, not a right. Education becomes a right in states only insofar as the states mandate public education, and that is spelled out in their constitution. But by the same token, any state in America, at any given moment, the assembly in a state could decide to not have public education. If it wants to cut its budget, for example, by saying, let's get rid of public education, every state has a right under the U.S. Constitution to get rid of public education. So it's really not a right, even though we often think of it as a right. Now, it is the case that once states do mandate public education, then rights do come into question, as in the 14th Amendment, equal protection, due process, and so forth. But I think there is an ongoing debate, and something new has been added to it because there's a whole movement now to view education as a human right. But the fact is that under our Constitution, education is not a right. But the other question as to whether states have a responsibility to educate its citizens is not dependent on whether it's a right. It's a question of whether it's a responsibility, both in terms of a moral responsibility, but also in terms of the kinds of informed and independent-minded citizens that are necessary for democratic culture. And so I think it's in that realm that states do have the responsibility to educate its citizens. I am not opposed to private education, to charter schools, to parochial schools, to quasi-public schools, but my sense is that as long as we have 53 million school kids, the only way to educate them effectively and to have something to assume that responsibility and be beholden to the rest of society, that education should be centrally a state system.
I'm surprised. Both of you seem to agree education's not an innate right, though I see Andrew talks about individuals all feeling a personal desire that everyone be educated, whereas Jim thinks it's the state's responsibility and, in fact, in its own interest to educate its citizens. Well, let's go on to our next question. How did it come about that the right to an education was written into every state constitution?
I think that we could attribute that more directly to one person than you usually can in such things historically, and that person would be Horace Mann, who was the first secretary of the first state board of education in the country in Massachusetts. And when that state board of education was created, I think it was in 1837, Mann became the most eloquent speaker on behalf of centrally controlled and directed state-run systems of education that this country has ever had before or since. He made the case that if you had a central authority that would ensure high standards for teachers, high standards for children, sufficient funding, that you would have a system of education, and here's where he made some promises that I think would be difficult for any school system to keep. He promised that if you basically expanded the public school system to its capabilities, it would end crime and vice and usher in a sort of a millennial age in American society. He thought it would cure all our social ills, and he didn't he didn't do a lot of research on comparing different kinds of school systems to see which ones work better. He had this vision right from the very start, and I would suggest that while he was persuasive, while we did all adopt across the states these state-run systems of education, they maybe haven't turned out to be as effective as he had hoped.
And Jim?
Well, it is true that the public school crusade began in New England, particularly in Massachusetts with Horace Mann and Henry Barnett and that group. But actually, the expansion of public education and state systems within the United States is part of the broader history of America. For example, at the time of the Civil War, there was no Southern state that had mandated public educational systems. And it was in the aftermath of the Civil War, the defeat of the Confederate states, that made it possible for a New England version of state-supported public education then to expand into the Southern states and also had to expand westwards. So it started in New England, but it's not as though there was this public school crusade that triumphed in spite of all other developments in American history, a civil war, westward expansion, and even after you get these movements, then there's a question of the education of women, the education of African Americans, the education of Native Americans, groups that were excluded from public education. So if we ask the question, how did public education become state-supported, state-mandated systems involving all kids? It is as complex as the history of America itself.
Now here, though there's much agreement, I think I see a pattern in the different emphasis. Andrew seems to personalize the history and lay the cause at the feet of an individual, Horace Mann. Jim, while acknowledging Mann's contribution, doesn't generally name individuals, but points to movements and groups. In a moment, we'll consider a question that I know will underscore your differences. Is it a good thing that the right to education has come to be written into all state constitutions? You're listening to Examining Education. This is Examining Education. Our topic is whether there's a right to education and whose responsibility it is. Our speakers are Andrew Coulson, director of the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom, and Jim Anderson, head of the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois. I am your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley. Let's now address a question that will highlight your differences. Do you think it's a good idea that the right to an education has been written into our state constitutions, or can you envision a better state of affairs?
Well, the answer is yes. I could certainly envision a better state of affairs. And the way that I've approached this problem is the same way that I approach problems when I was an engineer, which is to say, you know, what is our goal? Our goal is a universally well-educated citizenry prepared for success in private life and participation in public life. And I've simply studied school systems, different kinds of school systems, from classical Greece to the medieval Islamic Empire to modern school systems in Japan and Korea and England, Canada, the United States, and looked for the ones that do the best job of advancing those goals. And what I find is that the systems in which the state does not operate schools but merely facilitates universal access to schools that are operated in a free marketplace, those systems tend to outperform. And in fact, I wrote a paper for the Journal of School Choice last year in which I collected all of the statistical studies comparing outcomes in different kinds of school systems. And I found that the freest, most market-like school systems consistently outperformed state-run systems such as we have in the United States. So when parents are in the driver's seat, when parents contribute at least a little bit of the cost of their own children's education, it transforms outcomes for the better. So then the question becomes, what kind of system can you have where schools are independent, teachers have tremendous freedom to teach however they want and whatever in whatever way they think best? How can you make sure that all parents have access to that kind of system? Because right now, parents can't afford, in many cases, to get education in the marketplace. And I've come to the conclusion that programs like the one in Florida, which provide scholarships to low-income families that let them pay for tuition at private schools, are extremely successful in doing this. And I can talk more about those, but I won't run on just now.
Jim?
Well, I think that's where there's fundamental disagreement. One, I don't think we have ever had, nor do we have now, nor we like to have a free marketplace. I think we have a very regulated market, and I think recent events once again remind us with the banking, with the housing industry, with the bailout, with the recovery plans, with the loans to General Motors and other companies that, you know, it's not really a free marketplace. It's a place that is very much regulated, very much involved by government. Sometimes monopoly, in my view, is not a free market because you often get collusion, as we've seen in various kinds of investigations. And that can affect any system that is dependent on that kind of market. The other thing is that I don't look at this in the abstract. I look at what has happened, because we actually have historical examples. For instance, in Virginia, in the post-Brown era, what the state of Virginia did was to say, we no longer require public education. We no longer require public education. Therefore, we don't have to meet the standards of Brown. And we allow each school district to decide whether it wants to have public schools or not. So Prince Edward County, Virginia, decided not to have public schools. Go to a private mall. And what happened as a consequence of that, a whole generation, particularly African-American kids, did not receive an education. And for those who did, they had to leave at 14 and 13 to go to places like South Dakota and Illinois and Minnesota to live with families that would take them in order to get an education. The question that you have to answer is that if you leave it to the marketplace, who gets left out? Take Chicago as a system, 450,000 school kids, a poverty rate of 88%, parents who can't afford private education. What happens to those kids if we go to a system where public education is no longer provided for them? So far, I have not seen an answer. You can have this on a selective basis. You can have vouchers. You can have support to parochial schools. You could have charter schools. You can have this on a selective basis. But once you go to an entire system, you have to look at a place like Chicago and say, what happens to these kids if it's entirely a private educational system?
Andrew?
Well, I certainly agree that that's the right approach. The right approach is to look at the problems that we have to deal with and then try to find concrete examples of how those problems are being solved and where they're being solved most effectively. So can we have, first of all, large-scale systems where we just provide financial assistance to parents and then they go out and they find the best schools for their kids and have the ability to pay for it? Yes, there are large-scale examples of this. In the Netherlands, they have had a universal nationwide system of private school choice since 1917. In Sweden, such a program was introduced around 1992, and in Chile, such a system was introduced in 1982. And so we can look at all of these systems and see how they're doing. And in the Netherlands, for instance, they have this universal system which looks a little bit like a school voucher program, what we call a school voucher program in the United States, where the government, instead of sending the amount of money it would normally send to a public school system, sends that money to the parent. And then the parent chooses the school, public or private, they think is best for their child. Well, that system actually gives larger vouchers, gives more money to children who the state deems are more expensive to educate. And if they think that lower-income children or recent immigrants are more expensive to educate, which in fact the Dutch do, then they give larger vouchers to those families so that they have more money to spend than the average family on education. And we do not find that low-income families are further behind the rest of the society in the Netherlands. In fact, the difference in achievement between rich and poor in the United States is bigger than in almost any other country in the developed world. So we have had a universal public school system in this country for 100 years, and we still have a much bigger gap between our rich and poor students than kids in other countries, such as the Netherlands, where they have this kind of school choice program that really takes into account how hard it is to educate children from different backgrounds or different income levels.
Well, I mean, I think it's a good question, and as to what models from other places can actually be imported into the U.S. and actually operate within the U.S. culture, U.S. environment. When I look at the people who've gone elsewhere and studied voucher systems, free market system, I know Patrick McEwen, who's an economist out at Dartmouth, has done this. And what they discovered is that those systems really are no better than public school systems. I've watched people like Chris Lubienski here, who does a study of charter schools and their achievement results. And again, those very large-scale aggregate studies demonstrate that there's no substantial difference there in terms of achievement, whether it's a voucher system, a private system, or a charter system. And I don't think we have enough evidence at this point to suggest that within the U.S. context, those kinds of systems will actually outperform public schools, because to date, they have not. Now, you do have some very elite private schools, as you have very elite public schools within the state. There are places within the state of Illinois where your public schools are as good as any private schools, and they have $14,000, $15,000 per capita expenditures. They have teachers that on the average make $70,000, $80,000 a year. They have advanced degrees. They're public schools. They perform extremely well. And so it suggests to me that where you put those kinds of resources, whether it's public, charter, or private, you get those kinds of results. But no state, Florida, you cited Florida as an example. Let's go to the case where Florida actually asked a group of researchers to address the question as to whether reduced class size would improve the achievement rates of students within the state of Florida. And they came back with a fairly good study, you know, which is considered to be one of those studies that meet the gold standard. And they discovered that, yes, it would, but even more so, that African-American Latino kids within the states had even higher levels of achievement. The state of Florida looked at the study and says they didn't question the results. They simply said it's too costly. We can't put the money into it. And you're seeing that in state after state, that they're not willing to invest in public education. They, you know, whether it's pay for teachers, whether it's reduced class sizes, look at the STEM fields. Well, you need good math and science teachers. We have a case nationally. This was in the ETS study where some minority groups, a third of the kids, learned math from teachers that were not that are not certified in the subject. And in order to get people who are certified in the subject, it does require more investment, more incentives on the part of states. So I wouldn't take the lack of investment in public education or the lack of effort as an indication that these other systems will outperform them. And I also would like to see some studies. The studies we have don't suggest that at all.
Ah, here I see we have a clear point of disagreement. This is Examining Education. You're listening to Examining Education. Our speakers are Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute and Jim Anderson of the University of Illinois. I'm going to sum up where we are right now. Andrew believes a better system would be one in which the state facilitates universal access through the marketplace. He says this puts parents in charge and outperforms state systems. He mentions Florida's program of state-supported vouchers as a model. Jim argues that a free marketplace doesn't really exist, and where there is a marketplace, some people get left out. Jim cites the example of Prince Edward County in Virginia. After Brown versus the Board of Education, when the Supreme Court declared segregated schools unequal and illegal, Virginia changed its laws and no longer required counties to provide public education. Prince Edward County closed its schools, turned education over to private schools, and a whole generation of poor black children lost out. And Jim doesn't see large-scale education possible on a private basis. Andrew then points to the Netherlands, Sweden, and Chile, and claims such large-scale systems perform better and have smaller gaps between rich and poor than the United States. Jim cites studies that show that there's little difference in performance between public schools and other systems, and he raises the question of money and resources, particularly in the case of minority students. Now, to return to our debate. Andrew?
Well, that's a lot of really interesting stuff that I'd like to respond to. So we're finally getting to the part of the program where there are clear disagreements. Let's start with investment. I've been running numbers on this a lot because I do public policy work, and of course I'm asked, you know, should we have a $10 billion bailout for the public school system and this kind of thing, and so I have to look at the history of spending on public schools and see how it's changed over time and how employment and enrollment have changed over time. And I've been generating charts on this for the past 6 months or so, and one of the interesting ones that I did recently was to add up the cost of a K-12 education in inflation-adjusted dollars for a child who was graduating in 1970 versus a child graduating in 2009. In 2009 dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars, the cost of a K-12 education for a 1970 graduate was about $38,000. The cost for a graduate last year was $150,000. That's nearly four times higher. So in real dollars, we are spending four times as much for a K-12 education today in the public school system as we did 40 years ago. And achievement, according to the National Assessment of Education Progress, at the end of high school among 17-year-olds is flat. So we have not improved outcomes at all overall, and yet we are spending four times as much. Now, over that same period, we've hired employees into the system at a rate 10 times faster than enrollment growth. Enrollment today is about 9% higher than it used to be in 1970, and employment has doubled. It's grown by 100%. So we're investing massively in this system. We have invested massively in this system. We've added 3 million employees with hardly a rise in enrollment, and we have quadrupled what we spend on a K-12 education, and the outcomes have been flat. So the idea that we're not investing sufficiently in this system is completely at odds with reality. As for what the evidence shows internationally, there is, in fact, a very consistent and very large and obvious pattern, which is that the freest, most market-like systems do consistently and statistically significantly outperform monopoly-like systems like we have in the United States. And when I reviewed that literature for my Journal of School Choice piece last year, I included Patrick McEwen's work in Chile and elsewhere. It's just that his findings are somewhat ambivalent and are drowned out by the very consistent pattern of other findings. And I looked at 65 studies that report 156 separate statistical findings. So there's a huge body of work out there, and Patrick's is only one part of it. As for the U.S. evidence, certainly it is more tepid than the international evidence because, one, there's less of it, and, of course, it's harder to get very clear results from a smaller pool of studies. But also all of the programs in the United States are quite small. And so you don't have the opportunity to see real market forces in action with these tiny little programs that have a few kids in a few cities. But even that, even with those restrictions, there is no study of a private school choice program in the U.S. that finds it harms the achievement of students in public schools or private schools. And most of the studies show gains to the students for participating in the private school voucher program. And on top of that, the private schools usually cost about two-thirds of what the public schools are spending per pupil, and so they're much more efficient while achieving at least as well and usually better than the public schools. So I think the evidence is clear, and we are investing very heavily.
Well, a couple of things. One, in the case in Florida, we're not dealing with sort of a meta-analysis of this in the abstract. They actually had a study which demonstrated that reduced class size would improve the academic achievement of their kids in public schools. And the only thing that was necessary following that was for the state to invest in it. It refused to invest. And so, you know, that's the point that I'm making.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, you know, yes, if they could show that reducing class size, holding everything else constant, would improve achievement a certain amount, I agree that, you know,
that's
we might
be.
Yeah, right,
study.
Right. Yeah. And so we might want to invest in that if we had the money. Right now, states are going broke.
Exactly.
So ideally what we want to find, and I'm sure you agree with this, is something that will improve student achievement without costing more money. I mean, really, because we don't have more money. So we have to find something that can improve achievement without spending more. There's also a study of Florida done by Filio that was released, I think, earlier this year, showing that the private school choice program, the scholarship tax credit program in Florida, is improving overall achievement in public schools, and it saves the state money. For every dollar of revenue that it reduces state revenues, it saves taxpayers $1.49. So it produces a 50% return on investment, and it improves achievement.
Well, one thing, we've always had something that improves the education without investment, and that is children who are born into well-educated families. That has a very strong correlation to achievement. and to academic improvement. But what I worry about are those kids who are not born into well-educated families and whose families cannot teach them the math and science skills that are necessary to operate in a knowledge-based economy. They cannot teach them the computer skills that are necessary. I worry about those kids and how they might survive. I think the point I was trying to make about the study that people like Patrick McEwen did, they actually did go to to Chile where you did have voucher system, and he looked at it very carefully. Now, there may be other studies that find different results in different places, but that doesn't cancel out the findings that he got from his study in Chile. And so it raised the question that I want to address is what models, whether it's the Netherlands, whether it's Chile, are there models out there that could be imported into the U.S. and work successfully within the U.S.? We don't know that at this point. And if we're willing to take the risk, I think it would be a gradual one. You wouldn't abandon public education in lieu of something that we don't know whether it will or would not work.
That's an excellent point, and I'm entirely in favor of that same approach. In the Florida program, and let me just at this point describe how it works for listeners, because I'm sure they're probably not familiar with it. It's a program that allows private companies to invest in the education of low-income kids. So a low-income family wants to be able to send their child to a local private school because maybe they're not happy with the local public school. They go to a nonprofit private scholarship fund, and it helps them pay for tuition. It provides financial assistance so they can pay for private school tuition. Well, the way that's financed is that businesses can make donations to these nonprofit scholarship organizations and receive a tax cut for making that donation. So it costs the business very little to help the education of low-income kids. Now, this program has been growing over time, and it's actually been growing faster than, I think, almost any other private school choice program in the United States. But it only grows as fast as demand from low-income families grows. The only time that the scholarship funds start asking for more money from businesses is when they have a list of families, poor families, who want access to private schools and can't get it because the scholarship funds don't have enough money. So then they go out and they bang on doors and they ask for corporate donations, and that money comes in and it gets to the families. Well, this program has actually become really bipartisan. It's probably the most bipartisan private school choice program in the country. When they expanded it in May, it got almost half of Democratic legislators in support and almost all of Republican legislators in support. And as a result of this bill that they passed, it will now grow by 25% a year, but only if the program is showing very strong demand. So unless families are clamoring for this, low-income families are clamoring for it, and unless businesses are stepping up to help those families, the program won't grow. So I agree that a natural growth that doesn't blow up the public school system but just creates an option, an alternative for families, is definitely the way to go.
Yeah. And we've always had, I mean, historically, we've always had alternatives to public education. We've had parochial schools, and we've had private schools. And look at the growth of the Christian academies, you know, in response to school desegregation. You had a whole system of schools that cropped up. I think our system is always, at least the states and sort of the government and the private systems have always been flexible enough where you have all kinds of models. And I'm not opposed to when people say, you know, charter schools, well, charter schools is another model, or vouchers, that's a different question, but nonetheless is another model. But two things I think as a parent, how many parents would really want the education of their kids and the future of their kids even dependent on corporate donations? It's one thing to have a model within a public educational system, because if that model fails, you still have the choice of going back to public schools. They are there. They're mandated by the states. You have a right to go. And the other question is that if you have a government voucher or whatever the government gives you to go to a private school, that is just a government subsidized system as opposed to a regular public educational system. That doesn't make it private. That simply makes it government subsidized.
Yeah, I think your point about how many parents want their education to be supported by a system like this, I think that's a question that's answering itself empirically. The program in Florida has been capped. It's only been allowed to grow at a certain rate, and it's still capped, and it's not being allowed to grow as fast as it might if there were no cap and everyone who wanted that it could participate.
What's the total number of kids enrolled in that system now?
I think the total number of kids now in Florida is about 28,000,
mm-hmm.
and that started from zero in around 2002.
Right.
And it is, and of course the growth up until now has been capped based on the amount of money that the government would allow businesses to donate for low-income children's education.
Mm-hmm.
They were initially, I think the cap was somewhere around $30 million, then it was raised in the last few years to $88 million, and just this year it was raised to $118 million, I believe. But they're still, the government is not letting this program grow as
right.
fast as it theoretically could. But nevertheless, parent interest is growing apace. And what's interesting to me is that political interest in this program, bipartisan political interest, has grown at the same pace as the program itself. Because now almost every legislator in Florida, state legislator, has constituents who are benefiting from this program.
I'm not surprised that any model, when you think about it, have you followed the studies on the defense-related schools?
Yeah, that they tend to show higher performance.
Yes. Now, these are government schools, federal government
mm-hmm.
schools. And when they looked at the performance and they compared the particularly black and Latino kids in defense-related schools versus public schools, defense-related schools were at the very top. They outperformed all 50 states.
Mm-hmm.
And these are federal government schools, not state government schools, not mm-hmm. local district schools. I mean, this has got to be the height of government-sponsored education, right?
Yeah, and that goes back to what you said earlier, which is that you need to allow a variety of options to coexist so that we can find out which ones work well and which ones don't, and which ones work for which families,
because mm-hmm.
the same system isn't necessarily going to work for every family. But you're right that those Defense Department schools are doing very well, and ideally I would love it if we could have a marketplace in which people who have been operating those schools can figure out how to bring them to a larger community, bring them to families who are not themselves serving in the armed forces.
I'm not saying, and by the way, let me make sure I'm on the record. I'm not opposed to a system in which there are charter schools or parochial schools or private schools. They've always been with us. I guess it's the emphasis where we disagree. I am clearly in favor of a state system of public education, and I think you're more in favor of a private system.
Let me break in here. In a moment, I want to ask both of you a question about Diane Ravitch's latest book. This is Examining Education. You're listening to Examining Education. My guests are Jim Anderson of the University of Illinois and Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute. Let's explain to our listeners that Diane Ravitch is an historian of education and a policy analyst. She was Assistant Secretary of Education under George W. Bush, and she's now professor at NYU. She recently wrote The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Undermine Education. In it, she tells how she formerly supported choice, but now she opposes it. She says it produces schools that have as mixed results as public schools and that choice is damaging the public schools. What would you people say about her argument?
I don't think that they are damaged. That's her argument, but I'm not sure that they are damaging public schools. I think unless she's referring to the kind of ideology behind it or the politics behind it. I mean, if it gets to a point where it results in either a reluctant investment in public education or indifference toward public education, or even in the case of giving up on public education, then that would be damaging. But I don't think the existence of a few charter schools here or a few choice programs here, when I look at Illinois and again back to Chicago, there are 90 public high schools in the Chicago public school system, and there are like 10 magnet schools or selective schools, and they perform extremely well, as good as schools or good as private schools elsewhere. But the vast majority of kids in that system go to the other 80 public high schools. And I don't think it's the 10 selective schools that's damaging those 80 public high schools. I think it's the way those schools are being operated that's damaging the schools.
As for are my views on Diane Ravitch's work. They're totally compartmentalized into two different compartments. 4 years since I've been in this field, I've been reading her historical works. She hasn't been writing much in history lately, but she started out as an education historian, and she's a very good one. I've learned a lot about the history of American education from reading her works in conjunction with others. Her policy works, by contrast, I have never had a high regard for because they seem to be based on beliefs about what she believes should work rather than on evidence of what actually does work. So before Diane Ravitch recanted on a number of issues from school choice to national standards, I wasn't convinced that she'd made a compelling argument for these things in the first place, even when I agreed with the things that she was arguing in favor of. I was criticizing her work in the 1990s in the policy field, for instance, when she was strongly advocating national curriculum standards, because she made no empirical case that they work. She made no case that there's evidence that if you impose a single set of curriculum standards on every child in the entire country, that you will get better results. Then when she recanted that, she didn't provide evidence that she had been wrong in the first place. So I have the same problem with her views on school choice. I don't think she was the most eloquent arguer for them, and I don't think she's made a case against them either.
Well, let me intervene right now and say that it's time to turn to questions from our audience that were posted on our website, focusonedu.org. And one of the questions you've touched on, if government is not going to be responsible for education, then aren't we destined to become an even more two-class society, those who have and can afford education and everyone else?
I presume that's a question for me?
A question for both, yes.
Okay, well, I'll start. I do not think that words on paper make any difference to the education of children. What I'm interested in is looking at the kinds of education systems that actually educate kids well and for costs that we can afford in the real world. And those systems are ones driven by parent choice in free educational marketplaces. It is necessary at this point to have financial assistance for low-income families so that they can afford to participate in that marketplace. And not only am I not opposed to having such policies, I strongly advocate them. Programs such as the Scholarship Tax Credit Program in Florida and the similar programs in Pennsylvania and Arizona and Rhode Island, and also programs that cut taxes on middle-income families who want to pay for their own children's education. There are ways for the government to help make every family have the option of private schooling that wants it, and I'm strongly in favor of those. So certainly, no, I do not see this as in any way inhibiting access to low-income families or to universal education, but as the best way of providing it.
Jim?
Well, you know, I've been reading an interesting series of articles on Slate with the title "The United States of Inequality," and what they're doing is they're charting inequality in wealth from roughly the early part of the 20th century to the present, and they're demonstrating that there's greater inequality now than in almost any point in our history. And if you have a school system that follows the marketplace, why would we not get the same results in education that we get from the market?
Actually, we have, as I mentioned earlier, more unequal results in education than almost any industrialized nation in the world. And that is after 100 years of a state-level, centrally planned government education system fully funded by taxes. We have, right now, a terribly, terribly unequal education system. If you're wealthy, if you're the child of a wealthy family, even if you're not particularly bright, you are unlikely, incredibly unlikely, to grow up illiterate. But if you grow up in a poor family, regardless of how intelligent you are, you have a very substantial possibility of growing up functionally illiterate. 25%, I think, it worked out to when I looked at the International Adult Literacy Survey a few years ago. So right now we have just a system that's appalling in how unfair and unequal it is. What I'm suggesting is that if we give low-income families more choices, alternatives to the system that has so badly failed them, that they will have a much better opportunity, and indeed the evidence shows that they will have a much better opportunity to become active, successful members of society.
So let me make sure that I understand. You are proposing this mainly for low-income families?
Yeah, the kinds of programs that my goal is to make sure everyone has access to the marketplace. Wealthy people already have access to the marketplace. What I'm suggesting is that everybody needs to have that access. So, yes, we need programs like Florida's that are targeted to low-income families, and we need programs like Illinois and Iowa have that are targeted to middle-income families who have, you know, working families that need financial assistance if they're going to be able to afford private schooling for their kids. But do we need to give Bill Gates a tax benefit to send his kids to private schools? I don't think that's strictly necessary.
I just have a very difficult time. Maybe I'm looking at the history of the country and trying to figure out any point in our history where you could actually trust the welfare of low-income people, including education, to the private marketplace.
Well, look at the history of education in the United States from the early 1800s on through, say, the mid-1800s, when state-level involvement was sporadic, uneven. Even though there were common schools, those common schools had rate bills, which were essentially tuition that you had to pay unless you were completely destitute or an orphan. And alongside those schools, because parents had to pay for the common schools, they were much more interested in looking at alternatives, and there were philanthropic schools run by mutual aid societies,
right,
churches. There were all these options available to low-income families. You were not shoehorned into the one free public school system and no other choices. And when you look at the literacy rates and the rates of consuming books and newspapers, it was skyrocketing during that period. So I think we have
what
evidence.
What period are you talking about again?
The early 1800s.
Early
1800s. Yeah. If you look at, you know, the rise in literacy and consumption of newspapers, for instance, from 1800 to 1850, it's like doubling every generation or so. And you don't see that now. Now that we have the universal public school system that's free for everyone, we have this terrible disparity.
But if we go, if we're looking at that time period and the system nationally,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a time when you had almost a 90% literacy rate among white Americans, right?
Yeah, probably by 1850.
Yeah. Well, even before then, 1800, it was 90%.
Mm.
Now, for Native Americans, for African Americans, for other groups in society, what were the literacy rates?
Well, I assume it would have been abysmal, given that it was illegal for African Americans to be educated.
Well, not all of them. There was a population of free blacks of color, 500,000 people.
Yeah, yeah, but as
it was not illegal for them to become educated.
No, but there was horrendous discrimination even in the North at the time. Not
right.
that there isn't discrimination now, but
exactly.
If you read the background cases to Plessy v. Ferguson,
so even if you take
horrible.
That time period, you have vast majorities of vast segments of the population that were excluded and left behind.
Right. Yes, I totally agree.
I need to intervene because I want one more question from the audience and then our closing section. What does it mean for the education system to be shaped by the marketplace? Are we just preparing students for work?
Oh, I would say absolutely not. A marketplace is a mechanism for uniting people providing a service with people who want a service. That's all it is. So whatever families want is what providers will supply. If what you're asking for is a liberal arts education that includes reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also prepares the whole child morally, religiously, in character, then that is what schools will try to provide. And indeed, if you look at private schools today in the United States, you find that they are more than likely religious, that they place a strong emphasis on character. That's because that's what people want their children to receive. So in a free marketplace environment, you will get the kind of education that people want. And people want a whole education. They don't just want the test emphasis on three subjects that we get in the public schools today.
Jim?
You know, what concerns me about any shift at this point in our history toward a kind of free marketplace is that since 1979, we've got the greatest divergence in wealth we've had in the history of the country. And these studies are looking at market income, which excludes government transfers. And if we have a school system that follows that model or is even dictated by that model, I have no assurance whatsoever that the school system would not be entirely reflected of the kind of divergence that we're seeing in the marketplace.
We've come to the closing section of our program where I'm going to ask each of you to sum up or restate those points you'd like the audience to think about when considering our original question of where the responsibility for educating the general public should fall. This is Examining Education. Our guests are Jim Anderson of the University of Illinois and Andrew Coulson of the Cato Institute. I'm your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley. Let's start with Jim.
Well, my view is, you know, that we do have problems in our educational system, and problems that solely need to be resolved. But I still believe that it is the responsibility of states and of local districts to educate citizens and to provide for all kids, you know, a common or a K-12 education that is equal, in fact. And I would trust the public system to do that. Within that system, we've always had, we have now, we will continue to have voucher systems or private systems or charter schools and parochial schools, Christian academies, and so forth. That's okay. That's part of the system. But for the vast majority of kids, I think that the best system remains a good public educational system.
I'm really sympathetic to this idea that we need to promise something to all families via a public school system. It's something that resonates with the public. That's why we have these systems today, because Horace Mann, 170 years ago, promised that we would cure all our social ills if only we expanded the public schools to their capability and fully funded them. Well, we've been doing that, and we've been doing it for generation after generation after generation, and it is an abysmal failure. Look at the inner cities that Jim was pointing to and see the failure there. Clearly, this has not worked. Promises written on paper about what the government should provide to people don't translate necessarily into reality. And if you look at the research, which is what I've been doing for 20 years now, comparing different kinds of school systems, you find that the kinds of school systems that do deliver on those promises tend to be the ones that give parents power, the power to choose the kind of school they think is best for their kids. And, you know, I'm trained as an engineer. I would recommend that kids eat alphabet soup if that was shown to actually teach them how to read. But what does show has been shown to teach them how to read is giving them choice and power. And so that's why I think we need private school choice programs.
Well, I want again to thank our speakers, Andrew Coulson, director of the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom, and Jim Anderson, head of the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, for being on our program and for conducting such a lively and informative discussion. I want also to thank the audience for the questions they posted on our website. I invite our listeners to go to www.examiningeducation.org or to our Facebook page, Examining Education, to send us your comments about today's program. On our website, listeners who want to explore this topic further will find additional details about some of the citations and claims made by today's speakers. The topic of our next program is school funding. How are schools currently funded, and how should they be funded? We encourage you to send in your suggestions for future topics and for future speakers. I am your host, Elizabeth Goldsmith-Conley.